طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with an inside look at the obstacles and problems that Israel creates to harass and limit Palestinian businesses as they attempt to make it in a competitive economy. Two staff members working for Americans for a Vibrant Palestinian Economy, a nonprofit organization that builds bridges between the Palestinian and U.S. economies, have written an article published in Mondo Weiss. Layla Kaksau operates out of Houston, Texas, and Rima Abu Shaheen out of Ramallah. Together, they wrote the following article, which I will read. Quote, "We write to you from occupied Palestine, a beautiful land with beautiful people who are engaged in building an economy to serve their burgeoning state. We know all too well the real-life hurdles Palestinians must overcome to simply do business. We just visited a handful of firms in the West Bank and saw their reality firsthand through our work with Americans for a Vibrant Palestinian Economy, a nonprofit that builds bridges between American and Palestinian business people. The World Bank cites Israel's restrictions on trade in the West Bank and Gaza as a major factor in crippling Palestinian economic development. For the past 25 years, we saw billions of dollars invested in the name of economic development. The result? The recent Food Security Sector Index reports nearly 70% of families are food insecure in Gaza. The World Bank found unemployment exceeded 50% in Gaza and 30% in the West Bank. However, let us not concentrate on reports and statistics alone. Americans for a Vibrant Economy focuses on assisting specific businesses, which means we see the effects of occupation up close. We want to share some of these stories to paint a picture of just how hard it can be to build these bridges, as well as to depict how amazingly resilient the Palestinian business community is. Hussein owns a chocolate factory in Annabta, Al-Hijaz. We work with Hussein to access the tools and knowledge necessary for U.S. market entry. This not only means jumping through all the normal hoops of exporting to the U.S., FDA regulations, ISO certification, etc., but also facing the stark reality of Israeli control. Restricted access to water and electricity, both sold by Israel to Palestinians, can prevent the factory from working efficiently. Prolonged waits at checkpoints can incur extra costs, as transporting chocolate in a hot environment means expensive refrigerated transport. Before Al-Hijaz's product has even left the continent, it suffers unnecessary expenses merely because it is a Palestinian product. Occupation means that the movement of all goods in all ports are controlled by Israel. Al-Hijaz is forced to use Israeli transport companies to reach export markets. Adding insult to injury, Palestinians are often a captive market for Israeli companies. Holding an economy hostage has its benefits. Another of Americans for Vibrant Economies beneficiary companies, Transcend, a Bethlehem-based technology company founded in 2010, has been able to grow their client base across the globe, including a high-profile academic association in the United States. Despite what seems to many as policies aimed at redeveloping Palestine, a few companies have endured with a combination of grit, hard work, and perseverance. Betjala Pharmaceuticals, another firm located near Bethlehem that Americans for a Vibrant Economy works with, is able to produce a certain medicine due to restrictions on the import of necessary raw materials. Meanwhile, the pharmaceutical industry in Israel is one of their largest sectors, exporting products to the United States across the globe. We realize that most people don't understand clearly the web woven by Israeli occupation. It is an intricate web with little useful purpose one can make any sense of. Nearly 80% of Palestinian exports are destined for the Israeli market. This may be a surprising fact to many, but it is common for landlocked nations to majority trade with their neighbors. What is surprising is how interlinked and interdependent the two economies are. Americans for a Vibrant Economy recently began working with the Palestinian Plastic Industries Union, based in Hebron. After visiting with one factory owner, he said something that stuck with us. Palestinian companies sell a majority of their products both locally and to Israel. Israel gets a portion of the plastic bags from Palestine. He noted that just a few days' strike could cause ripples in the Israeli economy. Likewise, a similar few days of Israeli military closures could prevent Palestinian day laborers from entering Israel, causing negative effects on both economies. Israel can find other suppliers of plastic bags, but cannot so easily replace the cheap labor. Again, holding an economy hostage has its benefits. How can Palestinians build a growth economy when Israel controls all aspects of their economic life, from access to natural resources, movement of goods and people, customs and borders, custom duties, collection, and more? Palestine needs economic development in Palestine, not to contribute to Israeli economic growth. No amount of investment dollars can change the painful Israeli-made facts on the ground. Economic development without statehood has gotten us to this point, and that point is nowhere. Given all the challenges, it is a tribute to the determination of the Palestinian people that there are any stories of success at all. True economic development will only come when Hussein can export without the shackles of Israeli occupation. Until then, we will continue to build bridges with the hope that one day Palestinians will be able to walk freely on them. End of quote. From the article written by two staff members, Leila Katzau and Rima Abu Shaheen, who work for the nonprofit organization Americans for a Vibrant Palestinian Economy. And now on to our feature presentation, which this morning is a talk given by India's Vijay Prashad, a well-known Marxist intellect, author, and commentator, who addresses the Palestinian struggle. It was recorded about 3 years ago, before our last presidential election, but has continuing relevance today. It begins with an introduction by the Executive Director of the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center.
Good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to the Jerusalem Fund and our educational program, the Palestine Center. Welcome also to our online audience. My name is Zeina Azam, and I'm the Executive Director here, and I'm really delighted to have you all with us and delighted to have our speaker, our special speaker here today. This is Dr. Vijay Prashad, and he has a most compelling title for his talk, Palestine's Intifada, The Process of Liberation is Irresistible. He will examine the current revolt in the Palestinian territories and offer some historical and political context. Dr. Prashad will also look at how the debate in the United States by the citizens and by the policymakers is changing, as many simply do not accept the way the situation is framed anymore. He will add a critical analysis and depth to this framework, offering a more nuanced and informed alternative. And I think he will situate this all in international law and human rights. Let me introduce Vijay Prashad. He's professor of international studies at Trinity College. He's the author of 18 books and writes about many issues, including the intersections of freedom and liberation struggles in many parts of the world. Vijay is the chief editor at Leftward Books in New Delhi. The Hindu, a leading newspaper in South India, has selected his book, No Free Left, The Futures of Indian Communism, as one of the top 10 best books of 2015. His most recent book is an edited volume. It's titled Letters to Palestine, Writers Respond to War and Occupation. And here it is. This is a wonderful collection of essays and poems by important writers like Naomi Shihab Nye, Remy Kanaze, Teju Cole, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and many, many others. And it explores identity, politics, resistance, the experience of war, the situation on the ground in Palestine, and so much more. We've purchased copies of this book and we'll have them available for you after the talk in the other room. Vijay Prashad's next two books are the edited volume, The Death of a Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution, that's supposed to come out this year, and in 2017, The Lotus and the Settler, India, Palestine, Israel. He's really quite prolific. He's a journalist for Frontline and The Hindu, which are both in India, as well as Al Arabi Al Jadid and Birgun. In the United States, he writes regularly for Alternet. I've asked him to speak for about 35, 40 minutes, after which we'll open the floor for discussion. And our online audience can also submit questions to us on @Palestine Center. Thank you, and please help me in welcoming Vijay Prashad.
Thanks a lot, Zeina. What a long and interesting talk you've made me say. You gave the entire outline. Do I have to follow every piece of it? Well, I wanted to share with you, I thought on the plane ride to Washington, D.C., you know, I like to read things on the plane. It's a relaxing place. So I decided to read this book in anticipation of the election that is now coming, I guess, in a few months. And so I thought I should prepare and learn about the next president of the United States of America. And so I went and bought this book, which I recommend to you. It's called Quotations from Chairman Trump. And, you know, within a few months, it's going to be obligatory reading. So you might be arrested if you're not carrying it. You know, so I'm going to carry it on my person at all times, just in case. It indeed has quotations from Chairman Trump, you know, almost all of them are from his speeches. And, you know, you can open it anywhere. And there's just brilliance. Like, for instance, page 102, I seriously opened this randomly. I love the Muslims. I think they're great people. So, I mean, it wasn't people from Sweden that blew up the World Trade Center. So this is widely available in as they say, not so important bookstores around the country, at all Trump rallies. You know, I love writing stories about things around me, but writing about American elections and Verghese and Umar, since I guess you are in the middle of this now, it is a painful business to cover American elections. To be at the rallies of the candidates is excruciating. It's so hard to learn anything, you know, genuinely. You get yelled at a lot. That's one of the problems that I'm finding. I don't know about you, but I'm finding that people want to yell at you. In the middle of this entire presidential election, foreign policy is irrelevant. You know, there's, of course, I'm going to build a wall against Mexico, make the Mexicans pay for it. Everybody actually agrees with him. You know, I don't think Ted Cruz disagrees. I don't think Marco Rubio disagrees. Maybe they disagree on the height of the wall or who should pay for it. But basic strategy is shared among all of them. And I think sometimes I'm convinced that even Hillary Clinton agrees with much of this kind of agenda, super predator children, you know, things like that. On foreign policy, where is the substantive debate? There was that moment when Trump attacked Jeb Bush for George W. Bush's war on Iraq, which among certain circles sent a kind of frisson of delight through our bodies as we watched that, never having seen an American politician in a major, you know, mainstream thing actually attack somebody on the Iraq war and say it was a stupid thing to do. I think that's the kind of language he used. That's the kind of language he always uses. It'll be in the second edition of this, the exact quote. It's not in this edition. So there was that attack, but in fact, that was not really an attack on the Iraq war. There was no substantive policy, critique. Why is the Iraq war bad? Well, it's stupid. It sent the Muslims to Europe. I mean, you know, that's the level, playground level at which the debate was structured. There was no substantive discussion. Everybody, of course, genuflects again to Israel. That is there. That is, at that level, there is no change. We stand with Israel. I watched Marco Rubio give a speech recently. I stand with Israel. Israel is our greatest. You know, it's kind of pabulum. It's like saying, aren't we all human beings in this room? You know, everybody says it and everybody nods. But it's not America that's nodding anymore. And I don't think the consensus is as clear as these politicians believe. In the same way as they talk about no more taxes, no cutting taxes. You know, I'm not sure that the consensus against taxes is as clear in America. Because after all, what other explanation is there for the support that Bernie Sanders is getting than that people are not convinced that no more taxes is a good idea? In other words, the Sanders campaign is a repudiation of the tax freeze or the tax strike that the rich have been on. It itself is a repudiation, so it's not clear that there's a consensus on the question of tax. There is a hermetically sealed bubble in which this debate takes place, you know, around things like taxes or Israel. They all seem to agree. But outside, in Main Street America, if we can borrow their populist language, the consensus is no longer apparent. Israel is a difficult subject to talk about, as you all know, in this country. Unfortunately, I don't even know why I started writing about Israel, because it's brought me nothing but grief, you know. I mean, I personally, I'm not a Palestinian. I don't have a stake in this, in that sense. You know, I'm not fighting for my national liberation. I'm not a Jewish American who has a sense of, you know, perhaps anger that in their name a certain policy is being enacted by the American government. That's also a legitimate interest-based, you know, politics of Palestine. I don't have that. Okay, you can say I'm an Indian. And the Indian government has decided to have an alliance with Israel that perhaps will in very soon exceed America's alliance with Israel, just having promised to buy $3 billion worth of weaponry and being one of the largest importers of Israeli weapons in the world. In other words, I used to argue years ago that India has started to underwrite the occupation. But I started writing about Israel and Palestine long before India was buying arms from Israel. That began after 1998. Writing about Israel in this country is a difficult issue, because anytime you say anything that used to go against the consensus, the attack comes heavy and hard. Recently, I wrote a piece about the knife attacks in Jerusalem. I had done a series of stories in Jerusalem. I had walked around late at night talking to little kids. You know, one of the great things, it's such a beautiful city. You walk through the old city at night, it looks abandoned, and then suddenly around the corner come six kids running around. God knows what they're doing, you know. If I had the sort of Barack Obama mentality, I'd say, where are your parents? Don't wear saggy pants. Don't eat fried food. But I don't have that mentality. I say, boy, you remind me of myself, you know, being the naughty kid running around the city of Calcutta. I looked at them, talked to them, wondered, what are you thinking about the world? How do you understand your place in the world? And interestingly, of course, they want to tell you, they want to say to you, where are you from? They're so curious about other worlds. I find that interesting. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But what I heard them talk about the most is their feeling of immense humiliation from the settlers, who have essentially taken over their city and periodically march through the city yelling things, you know, pleasant slogans of protest, such as death to the Arabs. You know, very common slogan on a, you know, weekend afternoon when the Sabbath is ended, you march in groups. An Armenian businessman in the Armenian quarter said to me once, he ran out of his shop, he sells ceramics. He ran out of his shop, he said, and he yelled at them saying, what about me? What about death to me? Don't leave the Armenians out. Not just death to the Arabs, you're discriminating against the Armenians. What about the Christians who are not Arabs, just down here, etc. So these kids articulated this sense of what they didn't use the term humiliation, but sense of anger and maybe also a little sense of sadness that they were being treated in this way. And of course, you've seen these because these travel the social media, occasionally the children being checked all the time, but it's not really the armed forces that seem to bother them. It was their neighbors. Because after all, in a community, armed forces are expected to behave as barbarians. Your neighbors are not expected to behave like barbarians. And this is barbaric, to have people walk by your shops, walk by your houses, walk by your fathers and mothers and yell death to the Arabs. It's unpleasant. It's so unpleasant, in fact, that twice I watched security forces try to stop these marches. And you read about this periodically, that security forces are actually trying to stop settlers from marching through the old city because they're afraid it'll create a provocation. So in that case, the security forces are actually trying to maintain so-called order, that is, the order of occupation, rather than the disorder of this kind of humiliation. So I wrote this piece about the knife attacks, and of course, a million emails go to my employer. And interestingly, so was the same chain email, but they all say things like, he should be punished. He should be punished. Punished. Interesting word. Not he should be argued against, but he should be punished. And I thought, what do they want me to do? Get on my knees and march down the row of Calvary? You know, what is the basis of punishment? Why should you be punished for saying, this is what children said to me? Because how can you justify knife attacks? You have to be punished because you justify knife attacks. Ban Ki-moon, Secretary General of the United Nations, made a series of speeches where he said the author of the knife attack is not the Palestinian leadership, but it is the occupation. That was the UN Secretary General. He was viciously attacked by the Israeli leadership. Viciously attacked to such an extent that the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, no great outspoken person on many issues. If you know the career of Secretary General Ban, he's a very mild Secretary General. I mean, he's, you know, I would say on balance, given the balance of forces in the world and the institution he has to manage and the donors he has to deal with, he's a fairly neutral kind of character. He sort of drifted through his tenancy as Secretary General. This man, Ban Ki-moon, took to the New York Times editorial page. I don't know how many of you read this, but Secretary General Ban wrote an op-ed whose title was, "Don't Shoot the Messenger, Israel." That was the title of the Secretary General's piece. He got pilloried for that as well, by the way. "Don't Shoot the Messenger, Israel." There is a series of factual, you know, statements that need to be made about the nature of the occupation. Recently, I went to Williams College at the invitation of the Students for Justice in Palestine, and I started to talk about this, and the room was very crowded, and a group of people came, obviously, to argue against the position. And at the question and answer session, they started their argument. And they began to say, "You're justifying the knife attack. Are you saying, you know, an eye for an eye?" Of course, I always reply with that Gandhi line, "An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind." It's an irritating line, but actually, it doesn't. It just makes two people lose one eye each, and they have another eye to see with. So, you know, it's not entirely true. But anyway, maybe if you keep taking out eyes, you go blind. But anyway, some of these aphorisms are quite silly. Anyway, one young man started asking me the classic questions, you know, about Palestinians have always refused a peace deal. And he, you know, listed. I mean, so I said to him, "How many times have you asked this question to anyone before?" He said, "Yes." I said, "How many times have you asked this question to somebody before?" He said, "Many times." I said, "Have you ever had a productive discussion?" He said, "No." I said, "Then why do you want to ask me the question?" And he sat down. And so what I want to say, why I've done this, why I said, talked about the knife attacks, and I want this, is because I think the time of having those discussions is over. I think that moment of actually talking about Resolution 194, Resolution 242, this map, that map, this discussion, this agreement, what happened in Lisbon, what happened in Oslo, what happened here, what happened there, why did Arafat do this, why did... This time is over. This is not the moment to have those discussions again. Having those discussions is basically a circular futility problem. You get into a loop where nobody gains, everybody articulates their position, angers each other, and then walks away. The real debate is not this. It seems to me the real debate is whether there is an occupation or not. Because actually a lot of people believe there's no occupation. A lot of people who believe there's no occupation believe, therefore, that international law doesn't apply. So then the discussion is utterly different. If you don't believe there's an occupation of Palestine, then to have this discussion about the Palestinians as a people under occupation who have the right to resist, etc., is meaningless. It's fruitless. They are merely internal terrorists. They should go away. They should go to Jordan. They should go to, you know, America or go somewhere else. They shouldn't remain in Judea and Samaria. If that is the debate, that should be the debate to have on the world stage. Because 99% of the countries of the world believe there is an occupation. We need to establish that this is the discussion to be held, not the discussion about who betrayed which agreement. If there is an occupation, then you need to take the next step. And I think the Israelis are well aware that the avenues are closing, that if they are going to recognize, if they are forced to recognize it's an occupation, then the two pathways that had been provided over the last 60 years are essentially closed off. And they are closed off not legally, but politically. Pathway number one, which was by UN Resolution 194, is the one-state solution. In other words, this major resolution was about the right to return. If you acknowledge the right to return, you have people return to Palestine, they return to 48, they return to the occupied territories, you're no longer going to have two states. That's a one state. You know, there's no way for anybody who's traveled in that region for all the Palestinians to return to the West Bank. It would be a very congested West Bank. What would you do with the settlers? I'm coming to that in a minute. That's the one-state solution, and that is totally foreclosed by the right wing in Israel. I mean, it's a funny thing. People say, you know, cavalierly, American politicians will say, Hamas doesn't recognize Israel. I mean, you know, that's a normal thing that they say. How many of you have read the Likud Charter? How many of you read? Only you have read the Likud Charter. What kind of people are you? Two people? Got to read the Likud Charter. It's fascinating. Likud does not recognize Palestine at all. It talks about, it actually defines Israel as from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean and going all the way down into the Negev and, you know, whatever, the whole thing. It's basically greater Israel is what it understands its vision to be. And it doesn't see any place for a two-state solution. It is committed to one state which has got no Palestinians. Or if there are Palestinians, they are subordinate. And in fact, they are no longer needed because Palestinian labor has been entirely supplanted by contract labor from Thailand and other places. You don't need. I mean, how many of the kibbutzes in northern Palestine have any longer workers coming from Jenin? You know, they don't. They come from Thailand. I mean, it's always interesting to stand at, you know, Marun al Ras in Lebanon and look out at the workers that come right up to the line, you know, the blue line working, and they're all Thai. You know, they're all from Thailand. So the one state, which is Greater Israel, doesn't actually require Palestinians. They are not needed any longer as cheap labor or anything. So the one state solution is totally foreclosed by Israeli politics. It has nothing to do with Palestinian politics. We can talk about that later, whether there indeed is a thing today called Palestinian politics. But Israeli politics forecloses the one-state solution. It doesn't exist in its imagination. Impossible. Okay, so you have the justice minister, and some people will say, oh, we hate this government. There are always good people of course there are good people in the country. When he becomes president, that doesn't mean all Americans are like him. But he's going to still set policy. He's going to still build a wall that's 500 feet high and make the Mexicans pay for it. He's still going to do all this. You can yell and scream as much as you want, not in my name, I hate him, I'm not. But you are. As long as he's the president, he's your president. You can't disavow. So obviously there will always be people inside Israel saying, you know, this government is not my government, but this justice minister is for now your justice minister, and she, as you know, has many times tried to put forward a bill in the Knesset which is to have Israel formally declared as a Jewish state. Because Israel has this ambivalence about whether it's formally a Jewish state or not. Okay, so that's the end of that road. It's finished. The one state where Palestinians, Israeli, you know, we'll all live in a state together. I don't think it's possible politically. It's possible morally. I grant you that. It's a moral idea. You know, when people write about the need for a one-state solution, I would see that not as a political idea, but as a moral idea. The second solution, which is the established U.S. policy, is the two-state solution, which is established U.S. policy after Oslo. That's, you know, Resolution 242. Withdraw from the 1967 lines and let the Palestinians build a state. With, you know, even the Chinese recently reiterated this point with East Jerusalem as the capital, not Ramallah. But East Jerusalem is the capital. Chinese premier was recently at the Arab League where he made this very important speech reiterating, confirming that China is behind the two-state solution with East Jerusalem as the capital of the Palestinian state. That's the two-state solution. The flag is right there. It's all prepared and ready. But friends, where is the possibility of two states when East Jerusalem is barely under any Palestinian control, where the West Bank, the Jordan Valley, the most productive agrarian area is entirely captured by settlers, by Israeli military positions? How can there be a two-state solution when, let's forget Gaza, but the West Bank has the appearance of Swiss cheese? I mean, there is no possibility of a two-state solution. It is a mockery to talk about a two-state solution. And to think of Ramallah as the capital is a surrender of, in fact, the designations of Oslo. It's worse than Oslo, because at least there it was East Jerusalem as the capital of the Palestinian state. So this would be surrendering, going, you know, Edward Said called Oslo the Palestinian Versailles. This is actually even worse than the Palestinian. I can't think of another analogy. That's one of the great things about Edward Said. He could come up with these things in 24 hours. It's a Palestinian Versailles. He wrote an essay in the London Review of Books called The Morning After. This is just after Oslo Accords were signed. He said, it's a Palestinian Versailles. Wow, what a way to break with Yasser Arafat. Boom. You know, that's a tough statement to have made. Anyway, the two-state solution, it's ridiculous to even imagine that it's possible. You know, it's ridiculous. And I'm not even considering Gaza. So what remains? What remains is there's no possibility. And hence, frustration. And in fact, this is what animates Ban Ki-moon's speeches and that op-ed that he wrote. If you have a permanent occupation, per UN statement on colonized countries 1960, you know, the statement on colonization of 1960 passed by the UN General Assembly, occupied people will have the right to resist. You have young kids running around knifing innocent people as they walk by. That is the nature of an occupation. That is what is going to happen. This is not a statement of normativeness. This is a declaration of reality. If there is no exit for people, this is where they will be. When I was in Ramallah recently, some young leftist, young people asked me, will you talk about the Indian left? Because I have written this book about the Indian left. And I said, sure. And, you know, we discussed this at lunchtime. And they quickly booked the Edward Said Hall, actually, which is in the center of Ramallah. And I show up there, and the room was packed with people who had come from essentially the slums of Ramallah. These were young people. And they listened to, you know, this droning on about leftist strategy in India and all the debates and, you know, boring as can be. But these young people stayed the whole time. And then at the end, they came and they stood around and they wanted to ask the following. They wanted to say, what do you expect us to do? How can we build a political organization? Every day we get killed. Today we are going because a body is coming back of somebody who was killed. You think we can think about strategy? They were furious with me. But, you know, in a fraternal way. They were not angry with me. They were angry with the impossibility of building a productive politics. I kept saying to them, be careful. Don't do stupid things. You can't have an entire generation wiped out. You know, at least the children of stones, you know, fought in the way they did. You are not the children of stones now. I don't know what to call you. But this is too dangerous. You know, if every day one young person is getting killed here, there, you're running aimlessly with a knife at somebody, getting shot, this is not politics. This is the suicide of a people. But this frustrated them because they kept saying, well, what can we do? And I'm afraid this is where we are. We're at a point now where there is no leadership for these young people to craft a political dynamic. We here are stuck in old, boring arguments about who did what, to when, etc. But let's stop and think about how we could help in some way provide space for these young people to derive their own politics. What would it mean for them, you know, to produce their own politics? Let's spend some time listening to them. Let's spend some time, if we are writers, channeling what they are saying to people around us, to our neighbors here, so they begin to understand that this is not a question of terrorism versus the innocents. This is a question of young people who are utterly suffocated. In the Letters to Palestine introduction, I write that when you take a pillow to somebody's face and you suffocate them, they are going to fight back. They cannot be expected to lie back and die as you suffocate them. These children are the children of the pillow, in my opinion. They are fighting to move the pillow from their face. And all they are getting from the media around the world is belittlement and the title terrorist. But we're not seeing it from their point of view. I'm going to just pivot a little bit from this, and I hope we'll have a discussion. I'm not going to talk for much longer, maybe 10, 15 minutes, but I want to pivot from this to another side, back to the United States. Why can't we make this kind of claim about these people? The discourse of terrorism in America is very strong, and the peace movement in America takes actually a pacifist, has taken a very pacifist position, meaning we want to say violence is bad in all cases. We should never, you know, have, and I'm utterly sympathetic to that. I'm not a proponent of violence. Violence leads often to great destruction. There was a young Indian political figure who was killed at the age of 23 by the British government. His name was Bhagat Singh. And Bhagat Singh, while sitting in prison, you know, he took some bombs and threw them into a legislative assembly in, what, 1931? Somewhere around there. And Bhagat Singh in prison wrote a series of very important reflections on violence, on the role of Gandhi, on, and he wrote a line which is basically, it's etched in my brain. He said, peace or nonviolence is necessary for mass movements. Violence only in times of terrible necessity. So nonviolence is necessary for mass movements. Violence only in time of terrible necessity. Now, there's a difference between what he was saying and what these kids are saying. Although I'm not sure there's a great difference. I think the first sentence doesn't make sense to them. That is to say, nonviolence is necessary for mass movements. I think both the concept of mass movements have gone and the concept of nonviolence is bewildering. I think it's violence in terrible necessity that frames their politics. That is what is the horizon. It has collapsed on their heads like that pillow. In the West, it's very difficult to explain this to people. Because as you start to explain it, you get the classical response that you're justifying their violence. And particularly if people don't accept that there's an occupation, then the right to resist is not legible to people. So we have to find a language that enables us in this context, in the West, to talk about the condition of these young people, honoring their actually quite miserable condition. I'm not an idealist about people's condition. You know, I think it's a miserable place to be. We need to honor that place from which they're speaking and yet be heard in this context. It's not easy. It's not easy to translate that. I know, I said earlier, that the consensus, pro-Israel consensus, has cracked. And that a larger and larger number of people have now started to reconsider, you know, the knee-jerk support of Israel for various reasons, you know, whatever it might be. Some of it, most definitely, is the belligerence of Israel over the last decade. You know, the bombing of Gaza has, in a sense, sensitized people to the immense crime of the occupation. You know, 2009, 2012, these punctuated bombings. By the way, the American public is not always sensitized by mass bombing because, you know, our ally Saudi Arabia, about which I'm going to talk tomorrow at the Saudi summit, has been bombing Yemen since March 26th of last year. And I don't think I've seen even one demonstration, apart from Code Pink doing a few things, anywhere in the country. You know, all the pro-Palestinian groups should be out there, you know, making the comparison to the wars on Gaza, you know, on the vigils that are held when Israel is bombing Gaza. There's often vigils in cities. I don't see why there are not vigils against Saudi's war on Yemen, particularly given that in the middle of this war, the United States has been resupplying Saudi Arabia, which human rights organizations have said is complicity in a war crime. Because American cluster munitions are used to bomb civilian sites in Yemen, hospitals, schools, etc. And I think both Amnesty and Human Rights Watch have cautioned the United States. The European Union has forbid resupplying Saudi Arabia, but that stricture from the European Union is merely moral. It's not binding. Countries don't have to accept that. So England is going to continue to resupply. So I agree that Americans are not always sensitized by violence. Some of that is that maybe there has not been sufficiently a Yemeni solidarity movement. Palestinian solidarity movement has been building for 6 decades, so it has a more robust, which is why it should take up the cause of Yemen as well, you know, in solidarity with the poorest Arab country in the world being bombed by the richest Arab country in the world. Anyway, but these last few wars have sensitized people to some extent, and this has been also useful. This has been also because of the useful work of organizations across the country that have become, I think, more open and bold. You know, for instance, the group JVP, young Palestinians across the country creating little groups, you know, whether it's Adala or this or that. Everywhere you go, there's some group being more, I think, brave in coming out and saying even a simple thing like, I'm Palestinian, you know, and this is who I am. And I think this has changed the country. So when, after this Gaza war in 2014, you know, I asked these people to contribute to this book. And, you know, it was amazing. You know, I've done books before. I've tried to reach out to people, you know, important writers saying, will you sign a solidarity thing against it? Even in 2009, that was the last time I tried to do this, people were not willing to put their names to, you know, important American writers were not willing to put their names to things, you know. They felt they had too much at stake. This time, about 80% of those I asked said, I'll do it. And, you know, the happiest thing was to have Junot Diaz write the foreword. You know, this guy is like a MacArthur genius. He's like an American National Book Award winner. He's like every young reader's dream writer. Am I wrong? I mean, people just love Junot. Firstly, when he talks, if you get a chance to listen to him speak, he's extraordinary. You have to deal with the fact that he says shit, fuck, you know, that's how he talks. You know, he's like, sorry, I don't know what the PG level is. But he's so funny, which is why the title of his piece is so great. It's called Americans Are So Deranged About Palestine. And I just want to read you the last bit to give you a flavor of it. And this is definitely, I'm not going to bleep anything, because I can't bleep anything. He says, if you're occupying other people's shit, guess what? You're fucked up. That's that. And that's a tough thing for people to stomach. Because we live in a country that's currently occupying people's fucking land. Perhaps Americans are so deranged about Palestine because Americans are thinking, if we give up here, these fucking Indians are going to want their shit back. Well, maybe they should get their shit back. Since 90% of us don't own anything, I don't know how much it would hurt us. This is a famous American writer who says, I'm going to go right into the question of occupation. I don't want to discuss resolution this and resolution that and map section C321B and LMD and this and that. And I'm just going to go right to the heart of the question, do you think it's occupation or not? And that makes people rattled and they think. Now, this was good. The poetry is good. And the reason this is important, why I no longer want to write books that, you know, go through the arguments and systematically dismantle them, not interested. Why? Because I'm not interested in the head anymore. I'm actually interested in the heart, because I think that's where the problem lies. That there's been a corrosion in the American soul when it comes to this issue. That the soul has corroded. It has become either corroded or it's hardened into iron. So I'm not interested in talking to the head. I want to ask people, do you agree that it's occupation? If they say there's no occupation, I walk away from it. I'm too old to have that argument anymore. There's another 50 people I'm going to talk to over there who don't have that hardened iron in their soul. I want to go and talk to them. I want to ask them, is there occupation? They say, I don't know. What are you talking about? Well, let me tell you a story. Why do we, as people interested in this issue, always go and talk here? It's time we avoided these conversations. We need to go over there.
You have been listening to Vijay Prashad speaking in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.